Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
Well, here we are, the start of 2021. Over the past year, many Americans shared their lives with us. They were vulnerable and brave about what 2020 had brought them. So today, we want to listen back to some of the stories we loved best, the voices that lingered with us the longest. Let's start in April 2020. New York City was then the American epicenter of the COVID pandemic. Pablo Sierros is the owner of Forget Me Not, what had been a popular bar in New York's Lower East Side. When the pandemic hit, he couldn't serve customers anymore, but he found another way to keep his business going.
Forget Me Not. Yeah, you're looking for Paul? Just give me one second. He's just helping a customer. Just give me a moment.
That's all that's available right now.
We don't have speaking time.
Hello? Forget Me Not, it's like, it's like a local dive bar with really good food. It's mostly locals, you know. We've opened up, I think, June 8th, 2012. I think about 4 months prior to Hurricane Sandy. And that was a slap in the face right off the bat. So we made it through that. Then through a couple of blackouts, and now this. I mean, this is epic proportions, but it is what it is. What are you going to do? It's got to keep going. I was sitting with my partner, Derek, having, I think it was a whiskey. So we're thinking of what to do, and turns around and says to me, why don't we just do a grocery store? Plus, my brother owns a big supermarket in Astoria, Queens. That's where I grew up. So I figured, you know, I have the supply chain anyway. Might as well just do it, you know. So I went across the street, I got a bunch of plywood. So I brought in the lumber and we just built the shelves and that was it. There's definitely a Trader Joe's and a Whole Foods within 10, 15 minutes for me. But then there's huge lines and some people just don't want to wait. They just come, get their stuff. But obviously I can't compete with the big chains, you know what I mean? We do our best. But also we have full liquor. They don't. We sell a lot of gin and tonics to go, Bloody Marys, margaritas, whiskeys, you know, something you can't get in a big store. You see the same faces, you know, same conversations, you know, you check on people, they check on you, you know, back and forth. You know, you choose to help people, you choose to help yourself, you choose to keep sane, you choose to keep other people sane, and I think the mental health thing is going to be a huge thing after this. And at least I have the TVs. We play some old soccer games, you know, because there's no sports either. So that drives people insane. It's going to be huge, man. Listen, people, they've supported us through the years. Like, there's crazy, crazy support. So we give it back as much as we can. Okay, all we have left is each other. It. Yeah, Derek, lady wants to pay.
That was Pablo Sierros, owner of Forget Me Not, a bar-turned-small grocery store in New York City's Lower East Side. We recently checked back in. Pablo was in Greece, but we spoke with his wife, Abby Sierros. And she says they've reinvented themselves again.
We've got this cute little general store that's selling creative things that, you know, multiple people from the neighborhood have made and brought to me, scarves and candles and pillows and clothing and hats and fun stuff. We're just looking at this as an opportunity and not as something sad. That's how 2020 has been. You see a crack in the door and you push the door open and something better on the other side.
Abby also says they're looking forward to reopening the bar in the spring. Well, not everyone has been able to pivot as easily. In October, we spoke with Latrish Osecco. Before the pandemic, she worked as a contractor doing data entry, and her boyfriend worked two jobs to make ends meet. But when the pandemic hit, those jobs vanished.
I was able to receive unemployment benefits, even with the extra $600 stimulus. And I was thankful because I was able to bank some of that money, because little did I know it was going to cost me $604 a week in the motel. My landlord decided that he wasn't going to renew our lease because he sold the house. The only notice he gave us was that he wasn't renewing our lease. So that was 60 days. So 60 days was no time in a pandemic to find a house because people weren't moving. And that's how we end up being homeless. Oh, it was crazy when those benefits went away, because that meant that we probably wouldn't have food or anything like that, because we would have to use all of his income just to keep a roof over our head, meaning the motel. Things were rough because it seemed like everybody wanted to hire for work-at-home positions, remote positions. And because I didn't have the capacity to work at home, the motel's Wi-Fi or even my own personal hotspot was not good enough. So that cut down on a lot of jobs for me. Well, luckily, what happened was I had sat with the New York Times, and they encouraged me to set up a GoFundMe account. So through that, we were able to get over $13,500. And it wasn't just about the money. I'm sorry, I don't want to start crying, but it was just overwhelming. God sent an angel to the motel. I didn't know this person. I asked around because they came and they paid about 3 weeks to the motel for us. And they had meals delivered 4 days a week. A second round of stimulus would mean the world, because we pay for daycare. That was another issue. But I didn't want her to be a part of our adult problems. So I didn't want her sitting around the motel all day looking at me cry. Or if I had an interview, you know, I would have to scramble to see if anybody could watch her. And I'm lucky her daycare is on the lower end, $150 a week. But imagine right now, and I get $317 a week. So if I pay $150 a week, then that's at least half of my unemployment check. I don't know when I'm going to go to work. I just had a very nice Zoom interview yesterday, but I just don't know. You just feel so alone in this world, and it's still not over. Like, with this virus, it's just wreaking havoc in the management of it. And this unemployment nonsense, and it's just a mess. I'm just praying we continue to get through it.
That was Latrish Osecco from Newark, Delaware. She first shared her story with us in October. We heard from Latrish again. She had some good news. She has moved out of the motel.
We were glad to get back into a place of our own. It was a little rough, you know, in the motel and not knowing what was to come. Now my concerns are I need to keep my place. I don't want to go back there.
Latrish is still looking for a job. And to make matters worse, in mid-December, her boyfriend contracted the coronavirus. And that, of course, brings us right back to the root cause of this past historic year. Healthcare workers have been the tireless witnesses to the pandemic's deadly toll. We heard from a lot of them, including Emma Rome, an emergency room nurse at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. Emma shared her crystal clear memories half a year after the pandemic first hit.
He was like an otherwise healthy man in his early 60s, and he had walked into the hospital, and he was intubated within 20 minutes or a half an hour of coming to the hospital that he had walked into. And that was this very eye-opening, like, man, this is a really scary virus.
By then, Emma, an emergency room nurse at Massachusetts General Hospital, knew her whole life was about to change.
But I think what was hard was just being afraid of getting it and being afraid of, you know, that maybe my mask that had been cleaned three times wasn't going to be as good. And, you know, just that stuff that there was no real way of knowing.
and no time to really think about it because COVID cases were rising fast.
When the tents went up, it felt apocalyptic. Like they had, they turned the ambulance bay then into like this testing center, which was great, obviously, so people could get tested. But I think it was just, you know, it was just really wild. And you can always see people have like a special symbol, I guess, on their like electronic chart that shows if they have it. And I remember just sitting there and looking, you know, in the area I was with and every single patient having it. We definitely are just as busy as we were in the before times, but it's very challenging because everybody needs to be 6 feet apart. So we reach capacity in a different way and much sooner. My boyfriend also worked in the ER for, I think it's 17 or 18 years. And then he was told he had to come back to the ER. They rearranged everything. And anybody who had been in the ER was told that they had to come back. And I have two stepkids who are with us half the time and, you know, we love dearly. And it was a really hard decision because we had to decide right in the beginning of it to have them just stay with their mother. So we weren't able to see them and it happened just very abruptly. And it was devastating. And I think seeing it resurging again reminds me how scared I was and how it wasn't that long ago. And even I was just listening to NPR and I got really anxious. You know, they talked about making the tent and I remembered the tents we had and just how stressful it was and how alone we all were. I'm scared for it to happen again, you know, just because I know what it was like. And I think it's going to be worse this time because there's the flu, because the money stuff, you know, that we're not going to be able to shut down in the same way that we were. And I think anticipating that while knowing what I'm really getting into again is scary. I think it's really scary.
That was Emma Rome, an emergency room nurse at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. She shared her story with us in October. This hour, we're listening back to some of our favorite first-person stories we heard throughout 2020. Stay with us. There's much more to come. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're taking time today to listen back to some of the many personal stories we featured on the show this last year, this year of trial and transformation. So let's talk Zoom for a second. I mean, we have to, right? In the world of work from home and school from home, so many of us feel like we're trapped in those little Zoom boxes all day long. Well, last June, we spoke with Nate Crowley, reviews editor at Rock Paper Shotgun, an independent site that reports on the video game industry. And he had a great story about one of his friends who decided to dump Zoom and instead hold office meetings inside a video game.
To break the monotony, they decided to try and work out where would be the least appropriate place possible to meet. And Viv suggested Red Dead Redemption 2, which is, for those not familiar, an exactingly detailed cowboy simulator, essentially. In the online mode, you get together with a posse of cowboys. Cowboys, in this case, being a gender-neutral term. Anyone can be a cowboy. Your cowboys ride around an incredibly granular, realistic, you know, enormous depiction of the American West at the turn of the 20th century. And it's meant for this really immersive, almost sort of Westworld-like experience of being a cowboy. And they decided to use it for conference calling. So they started having their team meetings around a campfire with their cowboys, and it ended up being way more appropriate than they expected, because the cowboys sort of look like they're having a meeting. They're sat there around the fire, sort of nodding their heads, scratching their chins, and staring off into the middle distance with that polite attentiveness, but slight boredom, that well-acquainted colleagues will take on during a long meeting, talking about commerce as the wolves howl in the distance. And then, of course, there's Cripps.
Make yourself at home. It is your home.
Cripps is a non-player character. Is an AI entity who looks after your camp.
Place is pretty nice. I'll earn my keep. And I'd rather work.
Calling him artificially intelligent might be a little generous. He's this sort of wispy-bearded goblin who just sits around playing a mouth harp incessantly. In fact, you have to play a little bit of the game, or else the server kicks you off for being idle for too long. So Viv and their colleagues got around this by constantly making coffee. That's one of the things the cowboys can do, and it seemed, you know, again, like pretty good role-playing of being in a corporate environment. And it's quite a relaxing environment to talk through things in, because it's not all, you know, gunfights and dynamite. You can just have a nature walk. There's 234 animals in the game. There's like a dozen kinds of small, lovely woodland birds. You can just have a stroll around looking at the scenery, because it really is gorgeous. And yeah, it's the same effect as walking and talking with a colleague in the real world, only we can't do that at the moment. At a time where it's very easy to become sort of ambiently agoraphobic, stuck inside all the time, it's quite a release to have these outdoor spaces which are consequence-free. I think that's quite beautiful.
That was Nate Crowley, reviews editor at Rock Paper Shotgun, an independent site that reports on the video game industry. Well, another thing that a lot of folks, including us, thought about over the past year was how the pandemic might disrupt global supply chains or the movement of goods. Well, we were quite excited when truck driver Mike Manis reached out to us last May to share his story of what it's like being on the road.
Truck drivers, we have to keep rolling. We deliver absolutely everything that everybody needs and wants. Nobody thinks of us when it comes to, like, just COVID-19. Nobody's mentioned anything about the truck drivers and what we do, just how essential we really, truly are. We're the ones that bring it. No matter if it's a straight truck or a semi or a van, we're the ones that bring it. You know, a couple of the companies I go to, they make the masks that everybody in the world is trying to get, and I bring product they need in order to ship their product out. The company we work for, you know, they thank us, but it's not the same. Is coming from outside of our field, that somebody, not just to thank us, but to realize what we do out here and how it affects each and every single person in the United States. Not just certain people, not just certain companies, everybody, absolutely everybody. I just know at the end of the day when I come home, I know that I've helped an untold amount of people by the things that I bring, the things that I do, And I just thankful that I had this kind of job.
That's Mike Manis, speaking to us last May from Omaha, Nebraska. Now, he reached out to us to share his story, and in the year to come, we want to hear your story. So if you have something you want to share or a story about an event that's happened to you, let us know. Call us at 617-353-0683 or drop us an email at onpoint@wbur.org. A bit earlier, I called 2020 the year of trial and transformation. It was also a year of reckoning for this country as protests flooded American streets this summer after the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. And in many cities, police responded to protesters with force. In June, we spoke with Nathan Baca, an investigative reporter for the Washington TV station WUSA 9. On June 1st, he was reporting on a major protest in Lafayette Square in Washington, D.C., when he was tear-gassed.
I'm opening up a bag right now, since I have them inside this plastic bagging. I'm holding one right now. It says, CM Scat Shell, OC, 40 millimeter.
On that June evening, President Trump walked to St. John's Episcopal Church for a photo op. Just before 7 p.m., law enforcement officers from at least three federal agencies cleared protesters from the area. Nathan was in that crowd. Officers said that no civilians were tear-gassed that day, yet Nathan found canisters that had been fired at protesters by police.
You know what it looks like? It looks like a shotgun shell, a very big silver metal shotgun shell. When you look on the inside, you see it's scored and scorched because something was launched there with some powder and it exploded out.
Soldiers cannot use tear gas on the battlefield. But domestic law enforcement can and did use it on American streets.
We got there just around 5:30, and everything seemed peaceful. It was a very diverse and energized group. We saw mothers and fathers with their children there. We saw middle-aged folks. We saw people who probably, I wouldn't be surprised, maybe had been there during the 1960s and some of the civil rights movement. People chanting, "Whose streets? Our streets," chanting the name of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and others who had been killed in police brutality. This would have been right around 6 o'clock, and we found ourselves right on the fence line of Lafayette Square Park. We saw movements of police officers getting really close to the fence and getting to the fence line. And that made people nervous because they didn't know why they were advancing to the fence line just after 6 o'clock, because everybody had known through the news coverage that 7 p.m. was going to be the curfew time. I heard a loudspeaker coming from the police side on Lafayette Square Park. The first time, I just couldn't make out what it was. It was garbled. Then I heard it again a few minutes later, right around 6:15. One of our other photographers, Kurt Brooks, he thought, "I think they might be issuing a disperse order." And then around 6:30, we heard the first flashbang, that pop. Sure enough, you see that human wave of people starting to scatter. They were afraid about what was happening. The first push was mostly about shock and awe, stinger ball grenades, and a lot of popping, banging. And that was the first wave, and then people started to kind of collect themselves right alongside the intersection of 8th and 17th. At that point, it would have been around 6:35, 6:40. We started to notice these gas canisters start to get rolled our way. I remember running through the smoke from those canisters, and it was like this yellowish-green color. And I remember seeing this line of police just march south, almost like some Civil War battle line, just marching south, firing off these canisters, and they were launching them at distance. I won't forget that because they were like lobbying them, not rolling them. They were being fired as they were marching south on 17th, south of H Street, past Pennsylvania Avenue. I cried like I hadn't experienced before. It certainly wasn't an emotional cry. It was the cry of there's something burning your eyes and your tear ducts just won't stop. Becca, our photojournalist, she was just coughing quite a bit. we're running on adrenaline because we're all running south on 17th Street, south of H Street, and trying to get to safety because our security guard was just trying to pull us across the side of the street to avoid, as best we could, these gas canisters that are starting to keep on rolling past us. And you see in our video, as we're running, we change direction quickly to the right because we see a canister that is smoking this sort of yellowish-greenish tint rolling two people in front of us at our feet.
We're going to move to the right, across the street. Let's go.
We just watched it. We were still going live on our air on WSA9.
Mounted police are taking over this section of 8th Street as they're telling everybody to move back, but it's happening so quickly that people are basically tripping and collapsing.
And then we rounded the corner again after a little bit because I was hearing in my earpiece that the president was at the Rose Garden. Then we started to hear in the earpiece that president is walking across to the Episcopal Church, just where we were. The four of us, myself, photojournalist Becca Nyer, sports anchor Darren Hayes, and our security, our John, we were all just there at that intersection, and we started to take notice of the things that were on the ground, on the street, and we noticed these canisters or the remnants of this stinger ball grenade, and we just started to pick them up. Darren and I, we took those canisters and we split them up amongst each other. And I remembered, wait a minute, his looked slightly different. His had different markings on it. Mine was orange, his was light blue. And so I called him up and I said, I need you to show me, take a picture, what your canister looks like. And he did, and it was exactly how I remembered it. It was light blue and it said CS gas. I was like, that right there is further evidence that one of the agencies that cleared Lafayette Park that Monday used artificial tear gas, a gas that is something that everybody was denying was used, but it was used, and there was the evidence of it. When I view the video of what happened and still hear those screams of people confused, shocked, some cases physically hurt, you hear that and it takes you back to that moment. And whereas one could be thankful that most people escaped lasting injury, there may be a concussion here, burns and injuries there, it still was so shocking to all witness that as a communal group that it shakes one's understanding of what it is to be a citizen.
That was Nathan Baca, investigative reporter for the Washington, D.C. TV station WUSA 9. He was in a crowd tear-gassed by law enforcement to clear the way for President Trump's photo op in Lafayette Square in June. As summer moved into fall, we had the pandemic, we had protests, and a presidential election. Due to the pandemic, many states expanded mail-in voting and allowed early in-person voting, and a record number of Americans turned out to vote. So even in those early voting locations, sometimes it was a long wait. Everlene Rutherford voted in Georgia on October 12th, and she's got quite a story, beginning with a 10-hour wait to get to the voting booth.
I quickly realized, probably an hour in, that this was going to take a long time. There would be 15 minutes that would go by where literally no one would come out of the polling area, and the line just was not moving, and that's where I started to get frustrated. For those 10 hours, really, I had all kind of thoughts about leaving on and off. A lot of people did leave and was like, I can't take this. But everyone around was kind of cheering each other on, like, don't leave, you can stay, come on, we got this. I had to go back to my car and get my chair. They held my spot. Everyone was being kind to each other, laughing, giggling. I enjoyed that part, just socializing and being kind to people, no matter who you were voting for. Politics was all left out. also my husband was hitting me up and was like, stay boo, you got this. I have our sons. Don't worry about us. Vote. I try not to watch the, I get emotional sometimes when I think about it. I try not to watch the George Floyd video. But someone had posted a small clip of when he was on the ground and he was crying out to his mother. And I watched that clip of a couple of seconds and I just started crying. And I can't imagine my sons, and I have three boys, three black boys, young men, and I can't imagine that being one of my sons. And I wanted to stay there as long as I had to make sure that my vote and my voice was heard. I think it's quite ridiculous the type of lines that we have in Georgia. To me, when we had the primaries earlier this year, there was extremely long lines as well. I would have thought that they would have added more polling places, did some type of action in order to prevent this again for the actual election. And I really have not seen any changes. So to me, they want long lines. They don't want people to get out and vote. They don't want people's voices to be heard. It's ridiculous that we're still doing stuff like this nowadays. Like this is still not fixed.
That was Everlene Rutherford. She lives in Kennesaw, Georgia, and she waited in line for 10 hours to vote in October. Well, this hour, we're listening back to some of our favorite personal stories we featured on the show in 2020. Stay with us. More to come. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're listening back to some of our favorite first-person stories we featured on the show in 2020. Some of them have been heartbreaking, but others just transported us.
This is the place where the forest meets the sea. You know, many of us think of a national forest as just a bunch of trees, but this is so much more than that.
That's Amy Gulick, a writer and photojournalist who has spent lots of time in the Tongass National Forest in southeast Alaska. And why the Tongass? Well, the Tongass National Forest is one of the largest intact temperate rainforests left in the world. And as a national forest, the land serves many purposes. In late October, the Trump administration removed decades-old protections on the Tongass, opening it up to potential logging, mining, and other development. So although we did spend an hour talking about the future of the forest, Amy Gulick guided us through the beauty of the forest as it is right now.
So you'll see very steep forested mountains that seem to just rise out of the ocean, and that's on the mainland. And then just off that mainland, there are thousands and thousands of forested islands, and those are also part of the Tongass. So this is a place where the forest meets the sea, you know, where waterways are weaving amongst all of these islands. It's a very wet, cool, temperate rainforest. Very misty, like low clouds will, you know, just kind of hover just above the treetops. But that's what I absolutely love about it. I think when I'm sitting on salmon spawning streams, what I love about that experience is that nothing else matters except what is happening right before me. and whether that's a lot of action, you know, meaning a lot of salmon are streaming by and there's a lot of bears around me. That's actually what I hope is going to be happening, you know, so I can be photographing that. But there are, you know, quieter moments too, where, you know, there's not a lot of bears around. And that's when I really start looking around and I really take in, you know, everything. So I take in the sounds alone are amazing. You've got, you know, ravens, you know, with these kind of harpy screams that they do, and they do these croaking sounds. You're hearing that, like, kind of reverberate all throughout the forest. You're hearing kind of the chittering of bald eagles, kind of the screaming and the screeching of gulls. And then what I absolutely love are the sounds that the salmon make, like the splash of their tails. If they hit a shallow spot, you know, in the stream, which they often do, to where half their body is out of the water and the other half is, you know, wriggling hard trying to get into a deeper part of the stream, you'll hear that tail slapping, you know, out of the water, and, you know, just hear their body wriggling. You know, a lot of times I'll just close my eyes and just listen to all these sounds. You can just hear, you know, how alive this place is.
That's Amy Gulick, a writer and photojournalist, talking about the Tongass National Forest in southeast Alaska. Okay, so I'm going to draw you back from Alaska here and back to politics, sort of. On Saturday, November 7th, Joe Biden addressed the nation for the first time as president-elect. He will be only the second Catholic president in U.S. history. And in his speech that night in Wilmington, Delaware, Biden referenced his Catholic faith by invoking a particular hymn.
It captures the faith that sustains me, and which I believe sustains America. And I hope it can provide some comfort and solace to the 230,000 Americans who've lost a loved one to this terrible virus this year. My heart goes out to each and every one of you. Hopefully this hymn gives you solace as well. And it goes like this. And he will raise you up on eagle's wings, bear you on the breath of dawn, and make you to shine like the sun, and hold you in the palm of his hand.
The mention of the hymn stood out to many Americans watching the address. Singer Lana Del Rey covered it on her Instagram.
Raise you up on eagle's wings.
The hymn draws from Psalm 91 in the Bible, but it was composed by Father Jan Michael Jonkas, a priest and the artist-in-residence and research fellow in Catholic studies at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota.
In 1976, I had dropped out of the seminary system for a while and was working, but wanted to keep friendships up with people that I had studied with. And one of them was a man named Doug Hall from Omaha, who had continued in the seminary system and was studying at Theological College in Washington, D.C. Well, when we came home to Theological College after a wonderful dinner, there was a message waiting for Doug saying that his dad had just had a heart attack. And the song was actually generated between that night and the wake service for his dad. I would say that the most common experience for me when people contact me about having used the song is in the context of funerals. So their experience of comfort and encouragement at the loss of a loved one is usually why they would write to me. Psalm 91 is part of the formal night prayer for Roman Catholics in a thing called the Liturgy of the Hours.
He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty.
And Psalm 91 is one of the psalms that's prescribed for one of the day's night prayer. So I've been praying it for years.
He shall cover thee with his feathers, and under his wings shalt thou trust.
And it came to mind when thinking about trying to create a song that would be of comfort and encouragement. One of the great blessings of living long enough to hear the song done in many different contexts is now to look back and realize that although it started in a Catholic ambit, it soon moved beyond Catholicism to other Christian denominations. So it was no longer confined just to Catholicism.
A massive car bomb exploded outside of a large federal building in downtown Oklahoma City, shattering that building, killing children.
When the Oklahoma bombings took place some years ago, I believe the wife of the governor of Oklahoma at that time asked that On Eagle's Wings be sung for the memorial service. And that was the first time that I recognized the song had gone beyond any even religious, direct religious context to now be kind of a civic hymn. And I was absolutely delighted to see that it could move beyond certain frameworks and make comfort and encouragement available to people in other contexts. When President-elect Biden used it in a new context, it awakened an entirely new way of interpreting the song for me. And I thought, perhaps he's thinking we are, as American citizens, divided about 50% against 50%. And here's the image of an eagle flying. It's impossible for an eagle to fly with only one wing. It needs both of the wings to be able to soar. And perhaps he's thinking we need both sides, the 50% and the 50%, to soar ahead into the future as a good country.
He will raise you up on eagle's wings.
Father Jan Michael Jonkas, a priest and artist-in-residence and research fellow in Catholic studies at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota. He shared the story behind On Eagle's Wings with us in November. You're listening to Susan Powell and the Oklahoma City Philharmonic perform the song at the memorial service for the victims of the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995. Well, finally, let's end today's hour on a note of hope and renewal. During the election season, we held a 10-part series of voter roundtables, and we heard from a cross-section of Americans, military veterans, newly naturalized citizens, suburban voters, young Americans, voters from across the political spectrum. In late September, we were joined by Ahmed Azouvedi of Beaverton, Oregon. Ahmed was born in Iraq, and he became a U.S. citizen just days before talking with us. So when did you become a U.S. citizen?
3 days ago.
3 days ago. Congratulations.
Thank you.
What was that moment like? What was the ceremony like?
It's a dream come true because, honestly, I was dying to get my citizenship before the election.
Ahmed got to vote. Living in Oregon, with its all-vote-by-mail system, he had his son take a video as he dropped off his ballot. And in the video, Ahmed does a little dance.
Because I was happy. This is, like, first time for me. This is, like, historical moment for me and my family.
So here's the update. It just so happens that Ahmed and his wife, Rasha, had something else to look forward to in early November. They were expecting their third child, the first born in the United States.
We thought it will be around like November 8, 9. We don't know.
Which, funnily enough, would have been right around when the presidential race was finally called. However, something even better happened. Election day arrives, and early on November 3rd...
like around 2 a.m., my wife, she said, like, I think I need to go to hospital.
Yeah, you know where this is going.
We are in the hospital, and everybody, like all the nurse and doctors, they try to focus. And I was watching news in the room, like ignoring everything just to see what we got. Like, and like my wife, she looking to me like, really? Like, this is, do you think this is the time?
9:22 a.m. Pacific time on November 3rd. Rasha, who, by the way, Rasha, I am totally with you. You were right to chide your husband. Rasha and Ahmed's son, Ali, was born.
I was happy. Like, for Ali to arrive at that day. Like, I said, yes, like, we have something, like, we'll remind that day forever.
Mom and baby are healthy, so Ahmed, Rasha, and Ali were home by Saturday. Ahmed told us when they learned the race had been called for President-elect Joe Biden, he danced again.
We danced together. The victory dance. So he opened his eyes like wide, and I think he asking like, what's happened right now? Like, why I'm shake like this? Like, so anyway, I don't know. Let's hope one day he will understand that. Honestly, I will tell him, we had like a big fight, like, I mean, an election. And especially with the big numbers, we got people to make them involved with the election. This is victory. And this is for both sides. They need to be proud of it. And for him, I will tell him we will not forget his birthday because it's election day. And I will keep feeding him ideas that we need to keep this nation united and work for the better future for our kids.
And that's the thing, isn't it? Sometimes it takes a new American, like Ahmed, to remind us. This man, who came from Iraq, who says he saw firsthand the war-torn, blood-soaked costs of insurmountable division.
For that, I moved. So our responsibility to stand for this nation and not let any politician to try to divide us.
Every 4 years, Americans from all walks of life, all political persuasions, have the chance to touch the spirit of renewal. The process is imperfect, but the opportunity is there. So there's one last thing we asked Ahmed Azuvedi to do for us. We asked him to record a message for his son, the newest citizen in his family. And he did it, holding his baby in his big arms, stroking Ali's tiny cheek and chin. Ahmed spoke to the man Ali might become.
You know you won on election day, right? We love you. Because you bring all the good luck for our nation. Right? Huh? Baba? Habibi? Kalebo? Hey man, listen. When you growing up, let someone can make this nation united again. Or you can be that person who will make this nation united again. Okay? Love you.
That's Ahmed Azuvedi of Beaverton, Oregon, speaking with his baby son, Ali, who was born on Election Day, 2020. So there you have it. Some of our favorite first-person stories we were privileged to share with you this past year. And in the year to come, we want more of your stories. So if you have a story you want to share, let us know. We might reach out to you and talk with you in this upcoming year of 2021. Call us at 617-353-0683 or email us at onpoint@wbur.org. And one last thing. You hear my voice every day, but this show simply does not exist without our incredible staff. Anna Bauman, Jack Beattie, Jonathan Chang, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Tim Skog, Grace Tatter, and Sydney Wertheim. Special thanks to Graham Griffith. Thank you all for your dedication and hard work in what was a very hard year. You're amazing, and I am privileged to work with you. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll see you all on Point in 2021.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.